Okay, here we go again. Sometimes it's I enjoy laughing and having a good time because it really makes people start to think, how can a monk have such a good time? One of these is. Here we go. The first question this evening is, still a lot of questions here, an amazing cure for hay fever. Samadhi. Why does my nose stop running, saliva stop, no appetite, etc.? P.S. Living on sticky rice and AA nearly. Living on sticky rice, AA meal may have called Winnie something other than poo. Okay, anyway, amazing cure for hay fever, samadhi actually does. Whenever you're actually meditating, sort of all those symptoms disappear. They'll come back again afterwards, but while you're actually meditating, if you sort of take all, it's really strange, isn't it? You take all the attention away from these things, and the problem goes. The number one experience I had, maybe you had similar experiences, when I was a student once, I had a terrible cold. And I was in bed, I didn't go to the lectures that morning, and I was feeling really miserable, and just the eyes were running, the nose was running, and all the other people in the house I was sharing had gone off to college, and there was a knock on the door, and I was the only one there, so I staggered out of my bed, and it was my hi-fi system, which had been delivered from London, and so I was very happy to take delivery of it. And I was so excited that I got it out of the box, connected it all together, and put the first record on. And by the time I got the first record on, I realized my cold had gone. And it went completely, it disappeared. And it's fascinating just how much the mind plays in diseases, illnesses, sicknesses, and colds. So it's very interesting. Okay. Ajahn, what's Buddhism's position on human rights issues? Thank you. Oh, you've got a right to have hay fever. You've got a right to be sick. It's human rights issues. Again, it depends on which human rights issue. Sometimes that when we start with human rights issues with saying that all humans are born equal, things like that. That sort of is obviously wrong as far as Buddhism is concerned. Because we have what's obvious for anyone who's got any eyes, and you actually can see that human beings are not born equal. We come with our different karma. It doesn't mean that that lack of equality means that we should have lack of equality and opportunity. It's just that our ingredients we come with in this life, as I was mentioning yesterday with the simile of the two ladies baking the cakes, the ingredients which we bring into this life are different. And that does actually make an impact on our understanding of like human rights and what's actually possible for people. But also human rights I was very impressed with that philosopher Peter Singer on his book Animal Rights. I don't know if any of you have ever read that, where he was actually saying that the story of human rights started with European rights, mostly male rights, and then it started to extend into female rights, and then it started to extend into non-European rights, to Aboriginal rights, and I think it's only a matter of time when it extends beyond our species. We've gone mostly beyond racism, but we haven't gone beyond speciesism, as if that the human beings sort of can do whatever they like to other species. So I'd actually like to see human rights, not just human rights. I think that's too much for looking at human beings and neglecting the animal kingdom. It's like life rights or beings' rights. I think that if we look upon it with all of nature, and not just animals, but plants, etc., then we can have some huge declaration of rights. And also responsibilities as well, because this is what's important. So Buddhism's position on human rights the idea of human rights is very important, you know, to actually protect people from being abused. And that should be a part of one's duty out of compassion and loving kindness. But as I was mentioning yesterday, compassion and loving kindness without wisdom can also create lots of problems. At the moment, the agenda on human rights issues is very much coming from Western culture and is not acknowledging at all any culture other than the American European culture. And I think that it really does need to get the Asian cultures on board and discuss these things before they can really have a world human rights. Any questions on that or comments on that? The next time you actually see the UN Declaration of Human Rights, have a look at that. And don't just assume that this is good, this is good, this is good, this is good. And see just how you can look at that from like a Buddhist perspective. And you see that some of those things that is not quite right, pretty close, but they could be improved. Ajahn, regarding killing life, if termites are eating our house and we ask pest control company to get rid of them, this is against our five precepts. Thank you, Ajahn. It is against five precepts to kill termites. So, the nicest thing to do is actually move to a different house. Just they're teaching all about letting go, aren't they? Or, like what we do in Perth, in our monastery, you know the termites are around, so we make sure we build in such a way that termites, you know, they don't need to get in your house. So, you know, we don't have hardly any wood in our kutis. They're just made out of concrete floor, brick walls, and steel rafters. And that way we don't need to have timbers or trees cut down, and a steel roof. And sometimes these skirting boards, they eat those, but they can eat those if they want, because they're very easy to take off and replace again if the termites want some of those. So we're sort of living in harmony with the termites. And you know, make sure you don't have too much furniture in your house. If you have lots of furniture in your house, there's lots of things for termites to eat. So it's actually quite easy, actually, to keep sort of the precepts. It's only because we have so much, and we sort of don't take care in the way we build our house, because we just think of ourselves, we don't think of the other animals in the area. There's one of the huts which I built in our monastery in Perth, and I built it. I built many of the huts there. And there was a big ant mound just right outside the door. And it was not, being like a hilly property with lots of rocks, there wasn't all that many places you could actually do the building. So before I built, I asked for forgiveness and did lots of loving kindness to those ants. And whenever we had any of the building materials, I made sure that I protected that ant mound. They weren't sort of dumped on the ant mound, and all the wheelbarrows went round it. And I really cared for that ant mound. And so when the building was finished, I moved in there. And those ants never came in the hut at all. And they would always be sort of protective of the hut, as I was protective of them. It's amazing, just the good karma. Other ants in other nests would go into the other monks' huts, but they wouldn't go into that one. And even though the hut was right outside, or rather the mound was right outside the door of the hut. If you are kind to animals, you are kind to termites, and look after them, then they'll look after you. So, a lot of times the termites are just getting their own back because you've poisoned them or something, or done some rotten things. So that's what I would say. I mean, be clever if you build your houses so that, you know, the termites don't need to eat your stuff. Regarding the nature of the sea, a psychotic, depressive person watching the sea might feel like jumping into it. Can you explain this, please? A psychotic, depressive person watching the sea. Again, it's interesting here. This is like just the sea. And the sea really depends on what you're going to add to your perception. If you're psychotic, depressive, then perhaps you might sort of think of jumping into it. But if you develop the perception of the beautiful, you just really get off on the sea. It's beautiful, it's wonderful, it's lovely. So it's not the sea's fault, it's the person's fault. And it's the same with everything which we have in life. It's, you know, whether it's a meditation retreat, and it's how many more days to go? 2-3 more days of torture. Or 3 more days of lovely opportunity to be peaceful. And those of you who are waiting for Friday and already planning what you're going to do on Friday, when you get to Saturday, you start thinking, oh, I wish I was back on retreat again. It just really depends on what you add to what you're experiencing. So because of that, you are going to add something to whatever you experience in life. Knowing you are going to do that, you are going to manufacture suffering or happiness. It's, you might as well manufacture happiness. If you've got to go to work, you might as well enjoy it. Instead of thinking, oh no, Monday again, I've got to go to work. Just try and say, whoopee, Monday, time to go to work. Isn't this great? Get up early in the morning, I can do something good for the world, good for society, I can make some money, so I can make some donations to the BSV. It's a wonderful idea. you can actually, it's an opportunity. If you don't have any money, how can you make merit? So it's a wonderful thing going to work on a Monday morning. So it really depends on what you add to this. I could get really psychotic and depressive. I'm a senior monk, I've got to give all these teachings. Why can't people leave me alone? If I thought like that, I'd sort of, you know, I'd lock myself in my room and I wouldn't come out to answer questions like this. But instead, I decide to have fun and I'm enjoying it. So whatever the question is, I'll always make something out of it. And this is the time we're to see. A psychotic depressive monk will see a question like this and get angry at the person who asked it. But if you've got the perception of the beautiful, it's a wonderful question written on a beautiful blue piece of paper. Wow. And then you sort of don't get depressed. We make ourselves depressed. It becomes a habit of our mind. And I've seen that, people. They're completely fault-finding. I was, you know, like, you know the idea of like whinging poms. So I've completely rebelled against that. But a few years ago when I was visiting, I saw these two young lads, maybe about 18, and they're waiting for a bus. And, you know, there was no sort of seat there, so they were sitting on a garden wall. And the garden wall, instead of being like a flat brick, was one of these round bricks. And they're complaining, and they say they shouldn't make round walls next to the bus stops. Come on! At least you've got a place to sit down. You should be grateful for that. And this is what happens, because they grow up like that. And the newspapers encourage that, always complaining, always finding fault, and we become fault finders. And that fault finding makes you depressive. And in the end, that's why people do commit suicide. All they can see is the two bad bricks, as I say. So if you see a psychotic depressive looking at the sea, just see the beauty in that. Isn't it wonderful, just the beautiful blue ocean?
Like, they, to see, I guess, the terrifyingness or the dukkha of life, but one of them keeps balance while the other one freaks out about it.
I think so, yes. I mean, it's true that way. You see into the world what you put into it. So it's you make it terrifying. You know, I've already mentioned about ghosts. The ghosts aren't terrifying at all, because I was a member of the Psychic Research Society in London. And they've been, when I was there, this was about 30, 40 years ago, they celebrated their 100th anniversary. And one of my mates, I went actually to see him a couple of years ago, or he came to see me. And he's on the Ghost Hunting Council of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. It's a very nice sort of title. So it's only like a group of about 8 or 9 sort of academics who have this council, and they sort of meet every now and again to sort of discuss haunted houses in England. Great fun. And he's been investigating haunted houses all his life. And they've seen many, many ghosts and many hauntings. But the one thing they found out, you know, after 100 years of research, that never once, with all the haunted houses in England, has a ghost ever hurt anybody. Never once. He said that sometimes you get these poltergeist activities where things go flying through the room. and glasses suddenly lift up and go smash. He said many times he's seen that, but the strange thing is they never hit a human being. They just go past your ear, but never actually into your ear. And it's actually strange. No, it's like a proven fact. The only thing which ghosts can do is make you afraid. They can't hurt you. And once you know that they can only make you afraid, then you know, you don't need to get afraid anymore. They can't hurt you. It's what we add to ghosts is the problem. And it's
no, yeah. Sorry, just that whole perception that, you know, that life is suffering if there's no truth. I mean, I would imagine that if we could really perceive life, like there wouldn't be then, you know, if we didn't have his equanimity and kind of freak out about just how to, you know.
How about life? Yeah. Well, this is, you mentioned this in a question the other day, which is, someone was mentioning one of Ajahn Jacare's talks, which has actually come from Ajahn Chah's saying, which comes from much earlier on, about a monk sort of putting his hands up in the air with a huge smile on his face, saying, joy at last, and know there's no happiness in the world. Mm-hmm. Which is, it seems to be like a contradiction in terms, but when you actually understand that first noble truth, it's just so liberating, because it means that you stop searching for something you can't find in the world. And as soon as you stop searching for this elusive happiness, because you know there's only suffering out there, when you stop searching, that's when you find happiness. Mm-hmm. So it's a contradiction, but this is that first noble truth gives so much happiness when you understand and see it. Mm-hmm. That's why that it was a great relief to me when I was a young student, Buddhist, and I heard this first noble truth, and all the Christians were saying Buddhism is pessimistic, but then I couldn't work out why all the monks were smiling. Well, they were having a good time. If you're the guys who're supposed to be understanding this first noble truth, how come you're laughing so much? And the more the monks or the nuns understood the first noble truth, the more light-hearted they were. So this is actually what happens when you see that first noble truth. If you deny the first noble truth and think that life is happiness and life is a bowl of cherries, that's when you get psychotic and depressed. Because, you know, the truth and what you want it to be is separated by a whole ocean. And that causes depression.
Mm-hmm. Talking of psychotic depressives, they throw themselves into the sea. What actually happens to people who suicide? Which realm do they go to, or do they wander around for a while?
Well, we don't believe in suicide in Buddhism. Mm. You can't do it. Because after you kill yourself, you're still there.
Yeah.
You can't escape that easy. That's a problem, and that's one of the big problems, is because as soon as someone tries to kill themselves, they're still there afterwards. So, you know, it's just they've got rid of their body, but their mind, which is the real problem, that's still there. Mm-hmm. So they're really in big trouble now. So they get double suffering, usually. It really depends on why they commit suicide. If it's somebody who does it because of some health reasons, and they're very careful while they're doing it. Sometimes it can be not out of depression, but like a rational decision of loving kindness, what they think is loving kindness for themselves and for the other beings around them. And that's very different, those suicides, you know, well planned, well orchestrated, you know, because of some usually terminal sickness. And then they go and do it. That's much different than someone who just really just fed up because, you know, their girlfriend has run off with another boy. So, you know, all suicides aren't the same. But the thing is,
going to another realm.
No, it's still the ghost realm, but it really depends what they do next. Mm-hmm. Because it's bad karma for sure, but how they use that bad karma, they realise, wow, oh, that's a bit of a mistake, and they can come to their senses, or they can still see and hear, and a good monk or good nun gives a good talk and explains what's going on, and they can change. This is the thing with karma, it's very fluid. So you can sort of change around and turn around. But it's usually, you know, you're stacking the cards against you if you commit suicide.
So does Buddhism have a position on euthanasia?
The position on euthanasia is nothing is black and white. Every case has to be looked at in its own situation, circumstances. And just like I mentioned about breaking the precept of lying, it's like going through a red traffic light. nearly 100% of cases it's wrong. There's always that one case where it might be right.
Similarly with
abortion as well. Most cases. The point is with someone like abortion, it's usually someone who's been a bit sort of heedless getting in that situation in the first place. Mm. And that's where the problem was. But once that is there, it's very difficult. And all a monk or a nun or a good friend can do is to give helpful advice. You can't tell someone else what to do. You can advise them to make a wise decision. Whatever decision someone else makes in that situation, certainly I as a monk will never ever condemn them, even if I disagree with it, because I'm not carrying that baby. I'm not the one who's having to deal with that situation. So whatever they decide, I'll help them make a wise, compassionate decision, and then help them deal with that decision, even if I disagree with it. So that's what I think is a Buddhist position. Yeah.
Once I went to a monk and thinking about going on a retreat, he said you should watch out. He kept going on about a mind that's been affected by drug taking.
Yeah.
You can really spin out on a retreat or spin out through intensive meditation. I was quite surprised because I didn't think it applied, but.
Usually you don't spin out with intensive meditation, even if you have been taking drugs. Usually the drugs just take a while just to get out of your system, and it's just this sloth and torpor is the problem for people who have taken drugs before. And it's even the hallucinogenic drugs, sort of, they won't sort of repeat themselves in a retreat. So there's no real dangers in a retreat at all if you have been taking drugs before. Obviously, it's not a good thing to do. They have the time to work out of their system so you get your own mindfulness rather than the strange mindfulness which comes from drugs. There's no danger there at all. And also, if you've got a decent teacher, once you start getting some strange experiences, the teacher actually encourages you. This is okay. This is just perception. So don't add something to them which isn't there. And a lot of the time, it's the only reason why we spin out is when we start adding things to our experiences which aren't there. And that's where the teacher can really help. It's okay, you can see all sorts of images and stuff. For example, once as a young monk, I was a young monk, yeah, at this time, a long time ago. I was meditating and I had this vision in my mind of a demon. And this monster. And fortunately, I had enough wisdom at the time. I'd been taught well enough to realize that this was perception, creation of my mind. So what I did, again having a sense of humor, sort of had these fangs, dripping saliva. And I, just like I did at school with pictures, I blacked out a couple of fangs, so I had like holes in its teeth. And it's like big red bulging eyes. I put sort of sunnies on them. And all you needed to do was just like will in those states, and sunnies appeared. I put a sort of straw hat with a flower coming out, and the corners of its mouth I actually pushed up so it was squinting. And it looked so ridiculous, like a demon with sunnies on. But in my meditation, I laughed and never came back again. It was gone. And that was a very skillful way of dealing with sort of frightening images which come up in your mind. You recognize they're creations of the mind, and so you play around with them to make them funny, to take off the scariness of them. And if you've been taking drugs and had those experiences, you know intuitively that you can change those perceptions very easily. So if you get anything frightening in the meditation because you've had a history of drug taking before, change it around. Put sunnies on the demons. And then there's no problem at all. If any ghost comes to you, you'd be the first one to say boo. And then the ghost runs away. Does that answer the question there? There's no danger. Absolutely not danger at all. There's another question for me here.
Just a quick one about karma and suicide. The Buddhist monks who self-immolated Not yeah. through enlightenment and the Vietnam War protests,
yeah.
were they making good karma or bad karma for themselves?
It's really hard to say. It may have been good karma. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Because their intention, why were they doing that? What was their intention? They'd have to, they're the only ones who really know what the intention was. But certainly wasn't as, I would say, it's certainly not as bad karma as somebody going to the casino and gambling. Mm-hmm. If it was bad karma, it's more bad karma. There's many clear places of bad karma. This is why that if we have a debate about euthanasia or abortion or suicide, we should also include in the debate drinking alcohol and sort of child abuse, wife abuse, and all these things which are clearly bad karma, which no one does anything about, and we spend too much time sort of just tinkering around the borders of what might be good, what might be bad. Anyway, is ego the creation of a mind which is still attached to being, while non-self is the ultimate reality of non-being? Do we only experience non-self at enlightenment? As Buddhists, I can see why we would be encouraged to eliminate ego, the controller. But doesn't ego form a useful role as a convention for defining the current rebirth? What I mean by the ego here is the idea of a me who is doing things. The me is a controller. And me is just the way we look at, you know, this thing we call body-mind, this thing we call ourselves. And that's the root delusion which stops us seeing the Dhamma, which stops us being free, which stops us letting go of craving. As long as there's a me there, there'll be a mind. And when there's a mind, there'll be craving, there'll be attachment, there'll be suffering when we're separated from what's mine. So the ego is a creation of our mind, but it's almost impossible to uncreate by ourselves. Because once we have that view in mind, we see everything in terms of a me, a mind, and it's almost impossible to get out of that. The only way we can get out of that is actually almost like suspending all of our habits, all of our ways of looking, making our mind so still that we have got a chance to see things in a completely different way. A way which is so challenging to the way we want to see things that we can only, as it were, allow this new view to creep up on us when we're all our guards are down. The guards are the hindrances. They guard you from seeing truth. There's this simile of the Buddha which comes to mind at the moment of an emperor with his son. Most of the similes in the Buddha's time are all about kings and emperors and stuff, because that's what they used to have in those days. And the emperor's son was getting to the sort of age he should start like learning the ropes of the family profession. So the emperor sent the son off to a border province and gave his son, the prince, full command of the border province, as if he was king in that border province, because he wanted his son to learn basically by mistakes. Take control of that little province, act as if you are king. If you make a mistake, we can sort it out later on. You have to learn about the duties and the ways to rule. So he went up there with five of his mates, and after a couple of months, the people sent a delegation to the emperor saying, "But you've got to do something about your son. He's just partying all the time." Now, the first time that junior's away from his parents. Sometimes they do that when they go to college. So the emperor sort of talked to one of his ministers, a very wise minister, and said, "You know, can you just go and talk to my son in that bordering kingdom? Say it's all right to have a party every now and again. You're young. You know, you're a sort of a young prince. But, you know, do some ruling as well. You know, set up law courts and judge and just make decisions." The wise minister sort of told the emperor, he said, "Look, I know your son. I don't think he'll listen to me. But if you send one of your generals along with me, then I think the both of us together, I think he may listen." So the emperor thought, "Yeah, that's a good idea." So he sent the fierce general, the battle-hardened warrior, along with the wise minister. So the two of them went together. And when they got to this kingdom, when they got to the palace in this bordering kingdom, there was a party going on. And the guards there said, "No, keep out, you can't come in here." But they forced their way in, and they got to these five friends and said, "No, what are you?" So we come from, you know, the prince's father, the emperor. And the five friends said, "Look, we don't care who you come from. So if you get out of here, this is our kingdom, not yours. The emperor can just, you know, go and jump in the lake." And at that, the general got out his sword. And he flashed it in front of the noses of these five friends. And they fled immediately. They scarpered. And that gave him the opportunity to go right up to the prince. And the minister announced himself, "I'm the minister from your father, the emperor, who comes to instruct you on how to govern a kingdom." And again, the prince said, "Get lost, I don't care who you are." The minister was right. The little prince wouldn't listen to the minister. So the general got him by the throat and stuck the sword right in front of his nose and said, "Are you going to listen?" And the prince said, "Yeah." And so, with the general holding the prince by the throat, with the sword, you know, right next to his head, the minister instructed him about the duties of being a king. And he listened, and he understood. And from that time onwards, he ran his little province in a very good way. And after the emperor, his father, died, he took over the whole empire, and again became a very successful emperor. When the Buddha gave that simile, he said, "It's like I'm the emperor, and that little prince is one of my disciples, a good Buddhist. The five friends are the five hindrances. And the wise minister is insight, vipassana. It's not strong enough to teach you. You need a fierce general, samadhi, to grab you by the throat, absolutely still. And then insight has got a chance to teach you." So only when they're together. And this is actually a beautiful simile of the Buddha, which actually shows that you've got to be that still for a different way of looking at things to be able to get close enough to be actually to teach you that there is no self. Otherwise, that the five friends of the self are the five hindrances. And they'll do anything to protect the self. So, the ego is the creation of the citta, of the mind. It's the wrong view. It's protected by the five hindrances. And the only way to overcome that is to scatter the five hindrances with samadhi. That's always the way the five hindrances are dispensed with. To get rid of them long enough so wisdom can teach you. So that's how you actually experience non-self. Only in those moments when the five hindrances are completely absent. Traditionally in Buddhism, the five hindrances are absent in what's called upachara samadhi. Upachara means a neighborhood. The neighborhood just outside of jhanas. Because in jhanas, the mind is too still to even actually understand insight. However, there's two upacharas. There's the one just before you go into jhana, and there's one just as you go out. And of those two, the one just before you go in is very short-lived. The one as you go out is long-lived. And it's the one as you go out which is the important one. Because that lasts for a long time, that is certain, that is useful. And that's the place, traditionally, where people become enlightened, where they can experience and see very clearly the driverless bus, non-self. So once that is seen, you realize that that which you took to be a self, that which you took to be an ego, is just an empty process. Consciousness, will, doing, still continues, but is seen precisely as a process. Not a me, not a mine. So if someone calls you a dog, they're just calling the process a dog, not me. If someone calls you the greatest monk ever, they're just calling a process that. There's no person in there. So all pride and all sort of shame completely disappears. You see that what this we call ourselves truly is. So that's actually how these things are achieved, and the ego is no longer there. is replaced by the knowledge, by the mindfulness, the awareness of an empty process. That's all. Does that answer that very good question? Anyone want to say anything about it? Okay, that's the next one. Ajahn, can you please explain the feeling of effervescence like the fizz breaking up at the surface on the face? Thank you. All of these feelings which can come up in meditation, there are different types of what's called piti. That's when the sort of the energies start coming up. They are perceived by the body and by the mind, so in so many different ways. And as long as it's the fizz is nice, it's a nice fizz, not sort of a rotten fizz, then you're getting going in the right direction. But sometimes it can be just waves of bliss just breaking over your body like the waves of an ocean. Sometimes it can be effervescent. Sometimes it can be tingles of electricity going up and down. It doesn't really matter what name you give these things. The important thing is whether it's nice, whether it's pleasant, whether, oh, this is nice. If it's nice and pleasant, you're going in the same direction, enjoy it. Fizz out. Ajahn, I trust the male chaperones will keep whatever they hear in the interview to themselves. Thank you. There's an ego in there somewhere. I think many of the male chaperones are actually very grateful because what they hear is actually some things which they can relate to themselves. Because it's one of the things which I found out as a teacher. Once I started sort of talking to people, the first problem which came up, I thought that's very interesting. The next person who came to talk about their problems, the perception came up, I've heard that somewhere before. And the third person who came up, here we go again. The point is, we think that our problems are just with us. But the problems are the same with everybody. So you don't need to sort of be ashamed or think that there's something unique about you. You know, your problem is the only person who's got that problem. Everyone has the same problem from time to time. That's why I can relate, because I've had all those problems myself. So that you don't need to be embarrassed. If I really wanted to build my nun's monastery or build my monk's monastery, I could have made a fortune on blackmail over the years, what people have told me. You could, you know. I've got all these secrets which people have told me. Or the innermost things. But the reason why we're still struggling is obviously because I don't practice blackmail. And the chaperones are also will never do things like that because there's a sense of if you trust a person to live up to what's proper and right, they'd always do so. So you don't have to worry about the chaperones. Then Ajahn, in the process of trying not to get too attached to your loved ones and one's material possessions, is it good to contemplate on their bad consequences so that it will strike a balance? It is actually. It's a very good question and a very good statement there. If when you have like beautiful possessions, you always see the problem side of those possessions. When you get a new computer, always remember the times it's going to crash and cause you headaches. You know, when you get a new car, just think of all of the increased insurance payments you have to make on that because it costs a lot. And so you see the downside of the possessions as well as the good side of them. And that will keep you balanced. And when it's people, your loved ones, understand that some of the bad side of those things as well. In the One of the marriage counsellors I met recently in Singapore told me that a good piece of advice from her own experience. When her husband was about to marry her, sort of her father, his future father-in-law, took him aside and started talking to him, giving some advice. And said later on, this is to her now husband, said later on, he told him, when you marry my daughter, once you start seeing all her faults, be grateful for those faults. Because if she didn't have those faults, she would have married someone much better than you. It's true, isn't it? So if you see the thoughts of your husband or your wife, remember that if they weren't there, they'd have got so much more through. I really cracked up when she said that. But it's true, isn't it? That's why you don't get too attached to these things, because we've all got our faults. And that's the way that you can realize these are just people. You can either get attached to them or you get angry at them. So, and the same to yourself. Never get too attached to yourself nor too depressed about yourself. You're just you. You see the good qualities and the bad qualities, just like the wall. So a very good question and a very good suggestion there. Contemplate sort of the bad consequences, the downside of having things. And then you know what the deal is. You know, if you have lots and lots of possessions, you have to carry them around and burden yourself with them. So just know what you're buying into. Ajahn, what is it that part of the mind that understands the agitation or confusion and adjusts the practice accordingly? Like a wise, compassionate mother, gentle when need be, setting limits or challenging when that is what is required. That part of the mind is just that part of the mind which is conditioned by wise teachings from other people outside of yourself, by the reflecting on your own experience, which is the wisdom which grows from within you, and it's just developed over the years, over the lifetimes. It's called wisdom. That wisdom is what is grown like the flowers in your garden. And that part of the mind that understands agitation or confusion adjusts the practice accordingly, it is the wisdom together with the mindfulness, the two working together. Ajahn Chah, the forest teachers, would always, and they'd actually just talk about sati by itself, would always be satipanya, mindfulness and wisdom. Not just like a gatekeeper who keeps people out, but a gatekeeper who wisely keeps people out, knows who to keep out, knows who to let in. Knows the good from the bad, the useful from the useless, those who will help his city and those who will create trouble. So the wise gatekeeper will always keep out the troublemakers. Another word for mindfulness is the bouncer of the nightclub. Who knows who the troublemakers are? Would bounce them out. So that's what we should do, what mindfulness should do. If it's a wise mindfulness, it will bounce out all of the agitation and confusion. So it's wisdom and mindfulness which is developed over the years. Trouble is that some of the troublemakers always try to sneak into the nightclub. Sometimes they come in disguise. You have to be a very sharp bouncer to be able to notice those people. And this is, you have to be a very sharp sort of mindfulness and wisdom to notice some of the agitations and confusions. Now the five hindrances coming in disguise into your mind. One of the the most sneaky forms of the five hindrances which can come into your mind, and I should mention this because I mentioned this just to one person during the interview time, and it should be mentioned generally, because when I first read this in the suttas, I really, wow, this is amazingly deep. The Buddha actually started talking about the coarse obstacles to samadhi, the medium obstacles, the refined obstacles, and the most refined, which he called like the lingering obstacle to samadhi. The last thing before you get some. So what you're doing is amazing. You actually getting somewhere, you're seeing things, but that's actually an obstacle stopping you seeing what's just underneath that. And you have to be a very sharp and wise meditator to be able to overcome that, because it's very, you think it's, what's wrong with this contemplating Dhamma, contemplating Four Noble Truths, Anicca? The thing is, it's a long time. Just let go of that, be absolutely silent, don't do anything, and you get so much deeper. Good enough. Dear Ajahn, how does a mind come to exist in the first place? There is no first place. This is when people start to think about like the origin of the world. The origin of the world. If there is an origin of the world, first say God. Cycle of and actually there was in the suttas there was one monk who developed his meditation. Some wall or some line, but what's on the other side of the wall at the end of the universe? Didn't really make much sense. Now it's ready. Like, which sort of are bent. What do they call curved universes? Curved space? Yeah, warped, curved. And so that, still not really quite sure depending on how much mass is in the universe, but if they find a bit more mass, they'll find that this universe is completely enclosed. A finite space, but no boundaries. This goes round and round. just prompting the Buddha to talk about the end of the world inside. So that it wasn't really a major part of the teaching. It was just that, by the way, he happened to do this, and then he came back again and said, I can't find an end. You stupid mate, the end's inside. So, really good masters. Why, Ajahn, why is greed and hatred not eliminated at stream entry and only at anagami? Okay, this a good way of understanding this, perhaps the only way which is clear about understanding this and how stream winner, anagami and arahat are different. They have in Buddhism what's called that three levels of cognition: views, perceptions and thoughts. I mentioned them in that order, but really they form what is called a vicious cycle. If we have a view, then we'll perceive accordingly. The perceptions will actually be filtered out. Those which don't appear. They landed in the middle of Melbourne. How many people would actually believe them? If they came up and said, take me to your leader, they'd fall around laughing. Even if they didn't say that and they sort of, you know, had tendrils and sort of scales on them and spoke in some language, they think it's just some movie or some sort of advertising gimmick. Imagine how difficult it would be for an alien to be taken seriously these days. The point is, because people in their hearts, they don't want to believe in aliens. Therefore they wouldn't see them. Now that's like an extreme case, but that would happen. Sometimes, like, you know, your partner, your husband, your wife is in trouble. You think, oh, they're only joking, because you can't perceive they're in trouble, because you view that they're happy. They can't be in trouble. So much denial in family life comes because our views are so strong, we cannot see anything else, and we cannot perceive what's going on. The out-of-body experiences, there was a book by Dr. Moody, about people in the hospital who had out-of-body experiences when they were dying or operating on. And it was a multicultural town, city. And so they had all sorts of people. You know, Hindus, Christians, Buddhists, goodness knows who, atheists as well. And the interesting part of this was they all had these experiences in the body, going to the light, and going through the light, and then seeing the light appear as a being. And the funny part of this story was, if they were Catholic, that being they saw there was like usually the Virgin Mary. If they were an Anglican, it was usually Jesus himself. But the Hindus said it was Lord Krishna. And they were absolutely certain it was Lord Krishna, just as in the photos. The Mahayana Buddhists said, no, it was Kuan Yin. You know, the little long hair and the little bottle of nectar or whatever it is, just like they'd seen. And the atheists said it was Uncle George.
Thank you.
greed, hatred and delusion, then it's fueling samsara. If it's creating upadana, then it's more fuel for samsara. Samsara is like a wheel. It's like a dynamo turning it around. It's an engine making it go faster, keeping that turning around going. So it's not every thought keeps samsara going. Thoughts about renunciation, thoughts about enlightenment, thoughts about meditation, even thoughts about dana actually slow down the wheel of samsara. So only when you're mindful and stop past and future thoughts can be really mindful, are we shortening our journey of samsara? It's when you get into the present moment, you're given the opportunity there for wisdom to arise. And so you have to follow that path into the moment, into the present moment, into silence, into the mind, in order to find out where the engine is and just to turn off the gas. Aha, this is a good question. If karmic results continue on for lifetimes, let alone eons, doesn't this imply a conservation of identity? So, for that same period of time, can you please explain how karma relates to non-self? Okay, so karma is a conditioning process, or the conditioning mechanism of the empty process. So there is no self there, but there's a stream of consciousness. How it works from life to life and moment to moment is karma. So it's like the person is like, say, the vehicle, the car, and the karma is like the driver of the car, the karmic processes, almost like the physics of the car, the cause and effect of the car. So actually you don't need to have a conservation of identity to have like karma. You have like the old simile of like two snooker balls or billiard balls hitting one another. One is absolutely still and you hit one towards the other one, and when it hits it, one stops and the other one goes on. That cause and effect. Or the Buddha's simile is that the candle starts to burn down and you take another candle and then you light the new candle from the old candle. What went across? In this new candle, there's nothing in this new candle which was in the old candle. But there's been a continuity of flame. So that continuity, or rather that cause and effect process, is just like a string of pearls without any string through it. So nothing passing through one moment to the next, but there's a cause and effect relationship from one moment to the next. Cause and effect, like memory, is like having fax machines. You put a piece of paper, say, in Melbourne, and then another piece of paper appears in Perth. But there's no piece of paper going across between Melbourne and Perth. There's what is called in physics action at a distance. And one of the action at a distance laws is the law of gravity. No one's ever been able to find gravity waves yet. Or gravitons, gravity particles. It's just that something happens over there in the universe and has an effect over here with nothing going between the two. There's no postman taking the law of gravity from one place to another. In the same way, there's no postman taking karma from the past and delivering it to the present moment. It's action at a distance. An event a long time ago and suddenly resonating now. How karma works. From moment to moment, this moment to the next moment, there's no postman taking the information from the last moment into this moment. There's no self. Yeah? Yeah. I don't need that. You don't need to go to such lengths, but as they're there, it's not the box, it's next to the box, there's a little bottle. A little bottle called hay fever or hayfex or something. But by the time it gets here, I'll probably be back in Perth. But thanks, it's very kind of you to help out. Why do Western Buddhist monks take on Asian names? To confuse your mother. Well, it's in the monastery he went into, they still, they've got his monk's name, Ariesako. They keep their first name, so Ian Ariesako. But they're Jan Chah's monastery, they just use the monk's name. So, you know, Brahma Wangso was my name, but I usually shorten it to Brahm, because it makes it easier for people. Except sometimes, I went to give a talk at a girls' school once, and I introduced myself as Ajahn Brahm. And a couple of days later, I just happened to meet them in Perth. And they came up to me and said, "Oh, hi, you just gave a talk at my school a couple of days ago." And about 13, 14-year-old girls, you know what these girls are like. And I said, "Oh, yeah, I'm surprised you remember me." And they say, "Anyone with the name of Bra will never forget me." I did say that. That was enough. They're just having me on. It's a good joke. So no, it's just one of the reasons they said to give you the monk's name was because to make a change from your lay identity to the monk's identity. So if you have your old name, actually you think, you know, you're still a lay person, but you get a new name. It's as if that you realise, hang on, that I'm being called by a monk's name now, I'm a monk. It just reminds you to, you know, to, as they say, clean up your act and to be a bit more restrained. So it's just like a skillful means, that's all. Ajahn Chah chooses these. Oh, it wasn't Ajahn Chah, it was my preceptor in Bangkok chose that one. But these days, when I ordain people, I let them choose their names. Because I think it's much better, because they're going to have to live with that name for a long time. It's best if they actually choose a name which they can really sort of relate to and they really feel good about, and which cannot be misinterpreted by girls at girls' schools. A materialist, philosophically speaking, would have nowhere to begin to find this Dhamma. Please comment. They do have somewhere to begin, because a materialist, especially if they get into science, especially physics, it really leads into Buddhism. When it gets to quantum science and emptiness, this is very close to modern science. So many modern scientists actually are very amenable to Buddhism. They're not so much the theological religions, because there really isn't a place for a god. There is a place for will, for doing, the observer. And so if a materialist is really logical and reasonable, then they should be open, you know, to Buddhism. A materialist is supposed to be open to reason. And I often say that if we had, a jury to decide on the evidence of rebirth, you know, 12 true people, any reasonable jury, if it was presented with the evidence, would have to say, yeah, there's so much evidence for people remembering their past lives. There is rebirth. It happens. But the point is that because many people do not want to believe in rebirth, because they're a bit afraid of actually coming back again because they've been very naughty, that their view is so anti-rebirth, their perceptions and thoughts will not accept any of the very clear evidence. They'll do anything to try and interpret the evidence to be other than it is. In the same way, the boy with no brain, because the view of medical science is so strongly conditioned by brain, mind, there's something between the two. When they come across that, it just jolts their view, perception, thought cycle. And they can't accept it. It's just an anomaly. It gets outside of the cycle. They don't even think about it anymore. But if a materialist was really a materialist and was logical and was reasonable and was scientific, then if it's rebirth or the nature of the mind, you've got a CAT scan of a boy with no brain. Surely a materialist should be able to accept that. and to know that the mind has to be separate from the brain. Anyway, Ajahn, regarding the story of the ship captain and the monk with the gun, and what sort of calm would it be for the monk if he handed the gun to the crew, knowing that there was a fair chance that the crew would use the gun? Thank you. Someone's been thinking about this a lot. If the monk handed the gun to the crew, if he handed the gun to the crew with the intention that one of the crewmen would shoot rather than the monk, it would still be bad karma for that monk. It's just like getting someone else to do the dirty work for you. So all the rules of discipline for a monk are precisely the same. If I tell someone else to kill, then the penalty is exactly the same as if I kill myself. If I tell someone else to steal, you know, Mervyn, would you just go down to the shop down there and steal me a pizza, please? And we can share it later on. There'll be the same karma for me as if I stole myself. So you can't get out of it by getting someone else to do the dirty work for you. So in that particular case, if the monk with the gun had the intention to give it to another crew so they would shoot the captain, then it would just be the same karma. No, but if you tell the butcher to kill the meat for you, then it is the same. Then again, I thought... Hang on. Venerable Sir, at first I thought of letting go of desire to ask a question. But then the worldling I am, craving arose even stronger to ask a question. Then again, I thought of letting it go. And I can't. So he's asked the question, can you please re-emphasize ways and means of letting go of the procrastinating mind or proliferating mind. Okay, yeah. It's sometimes you get into these whole streams of thinking backwards and forwards. It is called conceptual proliferation, and it can go on and on and on. And you can see, like, philosophy books are like that. They start off with something very simple, and they make just a whole meal of it. And just politicians are the same. It's proliferation. It's a simple question, and they get into all sorts of thinking and ins and outs of this. And you find out that proliferation is called papancha. It's a result of restlessness. It's like the Hydra's head. In ancient mythology, the Hydra was a being with many heads, and as soon as you cut off one head, two more would immediately sprout forth. So they're very difficult to kill. Actually, I forget actually how Ulysses actually eventually killed the Hydra, because when one head cut off, you get two more to deal with. But that's like a question, it's like that. You answer one question, and then another couple of questions come up afterwards. And that's why trying to find truth through questions, through thinking, is actually endless, really, isn't it? In the end, we just need to be quiet and see. You've got this, the old Zen, remember that Zen story? About the two monks seeing the flag flying in the wind. And one of the monks said, the flag moved. And the other monk said, no, the wind moved, and they couldn't decide, so they went to see the master. And he said, you're both wrong, it's because the mind moved. And then they went to see the Theravada monk and said, all three of you are wrong. The mouth moved. I always like to trump Zen. Ajahn, does that answer that question enough? Okay. Ajahn, could we take literally your black hole theory of Nibbana and consider the stars to be advanced beings whose mind something dation upon enlightenment results in a black hole? If so, can we take hope reasonably in witnessing the universe's exponential increase in black holes? No, obviously that's just a simile of a black hole. I mean, just a black hole is where it just goes into nothingness, into cessation, into emptiness. The word Nibbana is actually people have write all these books about what Nibbana means, but Nibbana was quite clear in the time of the Buddha. When people saw like a flame go out, they'd say it Nibbana'd. And even villagers would understand what Nibbana meant. It means just something gone, cease, finish, poof, gone. And that's why that sometimes the Buddha would use that simile. He said, when a flame goes out, where does the flame go? Does the flame go east, west, north, south, up or down? Does it go into some sort of flame heaven? And every villager would know, when a flame goes out, it just goes out. All the flame was something which depended upon the wick, the wax and the heat. And when the conditions of fuel has gone out, then so does the flame disappear. There was no inherent flameness there, no self or soul, no essential flameness which has to go off somewhere else. It's just what was supported by conditions, once the conditions have gone, so is that which was supported by them. That's all. That which we take to be self is just like the flame, it's supported by conditions. Once the conditions which support it wear out, you go. Where do you go? Nowhere, you weren't there anyway. It's just like the flame, it's just disappeared. So, ordinary people don't understand. That's why Kisa Gotami, when she was a bhikkhuni, she saw the flame go out. She'd heard those teachings, now she understood what Nibbana was. And she achieved it. So that's actually Nibbana, the black hole theory, the cessation, the ending of things. But again, people don't like that because they want to be there when Nibbana happens, to enjoy it. All this work, all this striving, and then when we sort of get close to Nibbana, we're just about to have ultimate bliss, we're no longer there to enjoy it. It's like just, you know, you just got the ice cream, just about to get the ice cream, and then suddenly it disappears, just when you're about to bite into it. And the Buddha never had a mind. There was no Buddha. It was just the five khandhas, which people called the Buddha. So this is actually what the Buddha said. Look, when people said, where does the Buddha go after he passes away in Parinibbana? He said, look, that's a stupid question. He said, where is the Buddha now? Can you see points of the Buddha? Is it sort of the Buddha's body? Is that the Buddha? Is it the thoughts? Is it the consciousness? What particular type of consciousness is the Buddha? Is it the will, the doing? Is it the feeling? What is the Buddha? And he was saying, you can't see a Buddha even now. There's just this empty process. So how can you really think there's going to be the Buddha going somewhere after Parinibbana? It's just an empty process. It's now ceased. It was empty in the beginning. It's empty afterwards. It's amazing just how difficult people find that. Yeah? But it's especially the idea of a Buddha as being like empty. And that's why he said he can't describe and can't follow the Buddha. If you're an Arya, then you understand it's an empty process, you understand what the Buddha was meaning. But as soon as we start to think in terms of self, we'd always try and think the Buddha was a person, as a being.
None.
Yeah? That's actually, you've got a good point there, that if you ask someone else to kill for you, that you know, you're encouraging other persons to break their precepts, and you're getting the bad karma yourself as well. So you're getting the bad karma for actually committing that sort of act, and also for encouraging other person to do something bad as well. So it's true. Or if, say, It really, really depends, because taking instructions from someone else, that was actually in the Nuremberg trials, when the people who were serving under Adolf Hitler said, we had no choice, we had to do this. And there was a great deal of debate about it. Besides, it's not a valid argument. If you ask this something that's wrong, young adolescents, especially with all the hormones raging. But you know, once that sort of that knowledge of right and wrong is really established, you know, and you know what you're doing, then sure, you know, there is a sort of karma then, it gets stronger and stronger. Or if you're, you know, hallucinating through drugs, or you're drunk, it's obviously less karma because you're not really sure what you're doing. But it's bad karma to have those drugs and drink in the first place, obviously.
What is the karmic consequence of lying?
Karmic really depends on what the lie is. You know, whether it's just, you know, like lying to somebody who really, really trusts you. You know, like, especially like a teacher lying to their disciple. That's very powerful. You should never do that. But if it's just, you know, you're lying to the bus conductor, the tram conductor, yeah, I paid my fare, well, I can have a ticket just to Morven, but you're really going all the way to Dandenong or something, then, you know, that's sort of much less than if you're actually lying to someone who really trusts you and expects you to tell the truth.